I would like to first thank the organizers for inviting me to this workshop. And I was asked to give talk on testing GR using binary neutron star mergers. I typically start by showing this plot, which shows the amount of gravitational potential and curvature for systems that have been used to probe gravity. And solar system experiments fall in somewhere around here, which shows that these can only probe weak field regime. Binary pulsars, the system themselves don't fall into strong field regime, but they consist of neutron stars, which are very compact, so that you can test strong field effect. We now have Event Horizon Telescope, which can probe a supermassive black hole, which falls somewhere here, so they can probe very large amount of gravitational potential. I don't have it, but a cosmological probe that Tessa was mentioning was, I think, somewhere here. So they are also a weak field test. But the point here is that for gravitational wave observations that we now have, they fall right in this top right corner, meaning that they are strong field sources, but also they are denoted by lines instead of points, meaning that they are truly dynamical sources. So that's why these new sources are very interesting to probe gravitational physics. And today, I would like to give some overview of what test has been done using GW71 and 17. I'll give you a few selected examples. And then I would like to mention something that we should be able to do in future in terms of testing GR using what's happening inside neutron star or using some neutron star properties. So we need at least one neutron star to do such kind of test, which cannot be done by binary black holes. One example is the so-called spontaneous scalarization or dynamical scalarization. And another one is to use universal relations. And this part actually has already been covered by Phil this morning, so I'll try to go quickly. Okay, let me first give you some examples of tests that have been done already. One test is a so-called parameterized test of gravity. And this is a schematic picture showing the gravitational waveform. The red one is in GR, while the blue one is in some modified theory of gravity. And what you typically find is that if you go beyond GR, then you find a deviation in this phase. So you can create some template, and then you can try to compare that template against data. And this template is in non-GR theories. You can pick whatever theory you want, but a more efficient way is to construct a template in non-GR theories that is in a model-independent way. So there are several formalisms proposed, but the one used by the LIGO-BAGO collaboration is the so-called generalized IMR phenom waveform. So what they did is they took the inspiral part of the waveform that is given by a post-Newtonian expansion. Each post-Newtonian order has its own GR predict coefficient that's given by this phi k GR. And all you need to do is to promote this GR predicted coefficient to this times 1 plus delta phi. And this delta phi captures non-GR effect in a generic way. And if you'd like, there's a known mapping between this generic non-GR parameter, delta phi k, to actual theoretical coupling constant in some known modified theory of gravity. So this right plot shows the actual upper bound that has been placed by the LIGO-BAGO collaboration on this delta phi non-GR parameter as a function of at which post-Newtonian order the correction enters first. And what's remarkable is that at minus 1 PN order, this bound is strongly improved compared to binary black hole merger events. And by looking at this minus 1 PN order, what you can test is the existence of scalar dipole radiation. If there's some scalar field being involved, like Tessa's talk, then it's usually the case that this activates scalar charge onto neutron stars. If such scalar charges are realized, then there will be additional scalar force between two neutron stars, which will break the strong equivalence principle. In other words, by looking at this part, you can test violation of strong equivalence principle. So this is one test that has been done, and then this made a significant improvement over compared to the binary black hole merger events. Another test that they have done is to look for additional polarization modes. As you know, GR only predicts two tensor polarization modes, plus modes and cross modes. But if you go beyond GR, then there could be additional polarization modes like scalar modes, breathing mode is this blue one, and there could be also additional vector polarizations. And thanks to the great localization accuracy of this GW7017 for given by the electromagnetic counterparts, what they did is they did some Bayesian model selection analysis, and they compared three different models. One where you just have purely tensor polarization modes as predicted in GR. The second model is where you just have scalar polarization modes. The third model is where you just have vector polarization modes. And they did a Bayesian model selection analysis, and it turned out that the first model, purely tensor model, is way over preferred than the other two models. Other two models correspond to non-GR models. And the actual Bayes factor is something like 10 to 21, 10 to 23. The reason why these Bayes factors are huge is because of the localization accuracy, which allows us to break degeneracy between uncertainties in sky location and also this presence of these non-GR polarization modes. The third test that I would like to introduce is done by Maya and Dan and their collaborators. And this idea is somewhat related to what Tessa has already explained. So the situation is that let's imagine that we are confined on a four-dimensional space-time, but there is an extra dimension and gravity can leak into extra dimensions. Then what happens is that usually in four-dimensional space-time, gravitational wave decays as 1/1 distance, but if there is extra dimension and the number of dimension is d, then gravitational wave would decay as 1/(d^-2)/2. If you set this d to be 4, then you recover 1/(distance decay. This means that in reality, if there is actually extra dimension, but if you assume that GI is correct, then we will measure luminosity distance that should be measured as different value compared to the electromagnetic wave observations. And the reason is electromagnetic waves are confined in four-dimensional space-time. So what they did is they tried to get probability distribution of the number of space-time dimension d using this event, and they found that the data is consistent with the dimension being 4 with some small error. Okay. So these are some selected examples of the tests that have been already done, and now I'm moving on to what we can do in future, and one example is this spontaneous scalarization. This was first proposed by Damore and Esposito Fares. They looked at some scalar tensor series. Again, Tessa has already explained. Basically, you add scalar field on top of the metric to that can carry gravitational degrees of freedom. In the specific theory that they considered, there are two parameters, alpha and beta. But what's interesting for us is this second parameter, beta. This controls the amount of what's called neutron star scalarization. Scalarization means that there is nonlinear growth of the scalar charge being activated onto neutron stars. Let me give you one example that shows the amount of scalar charge as a function of compactness of a neutron star for various beta values. If you pick, for example, beta to be -3.5, then you can only have small amount of scalar charge. But if you have beta to be something like -4.5, then when the star is less compact, you start out with very small amount of scalar charge. But as you increase your compactness, then it hits some critical value, and all of a sudden, you acquire large amount of scalar charge. This is what's called spontaneous scalarization. There is nonlinear growth of the scalar charge as you increase compactness. And this kind of scalar charge is very important for like binary pulse observations because, again, if you have scalar charges being activated on the neutron stars, then they will emit scalar dipole radiation on top of usual gravitational quadrupolar radiation. So this is a plot showing the excluded region in alpha beta plane using binary pulse observations. The red one and blue one, the shaded region is the ruled out region, and red one and blue one are obtained by the absence of the scalar dipole radiation in the orbital decay rate measurement of binary pulsars. And recently, they found a very interesting system, the pulsar triple system, where you have a pulsar with white dwarf orbiting around each other, and there is another white dwarf outside of this inner binary forming a triple system. Then they can do strong equivalence principle test, and it turned out that it actually gives very stringent bound in this kind of scalar tensor theories. You can also test this theory by using solar system experiments. Solar system experiments, of course, does not prove neutron star scalarization, so they are not sensitive to this beta parameter that controls the amount of scalarization, but they are sensitive to the other parameter alpha. So the solar system experiments place a bound somewhere here. The next question is, of course, what can we do using gravitational wave observations? This rainbow contour plot shows what we can do if LIGO detects gravitational waves from black hole neutron star system with SNR of 10 with varying black hole mass. So depending on what black hole mass you have, you get different bounds. And I show also binary pulsar bounds in black and also solar system bounds in brown. The solid one is the one, the existing solar system bounds, while in future, Gaia is expected to improve the solar system bounds to somewhere on this dashed horizontal line. The bottom line of this plot is that it looks like it's difficult to use gravitational wave bounds to beat existing bounds, and this is consistent with what other people have reported, and the reason is we are probing scalar dipole radiation, which enters at negative post-Newtonian order, which means that if the velocities are moving slower or if the separation is wider, then this effect gets enhanced. But gravitational wave observations are probing what's happening very close to merger, where things are moving fast and separation is small. So that's why gravitational wave observations are not so useful to probe this kind of theory. But this picture will change in future once we have upgraded detectors. For example, if you have Einstein telescope, then we would expect to see thousands of binaries, and we should be able to stack those events. Then, depending on the number of events that we are going to detect with third generation detectors, the predicted contour for the bound in this plane will change, but it should lie somewhere in this shaded region, which is much stronger than the current bound coming from binary pulsars or solar system experiments. Even better, if we have space-based detectors like BDSiGo, which bridges the gap between ground-based detectors and LISA, then they can do even better job. So you will get orders of magnitude improvement in constraining this kind of scalar tensor series if we have future detectors. There's another related phenomena that's interesting to probe using gravitational wave observations, and those are called induced scalarization or dynamical scalarization. What are these? Well, let's imagine that you start with two neutron stars, and one of them has scalar charge initially, while the other one does not. Then you start binary evolution, and what you will find is that at some point of this evolution, the primary star that was already charged initially acts onto the companion neutron star that was initially uncharged, but it acquired scalar charge due to the primary star. So there is an induced scalarization due to the primary initial scalar charge. And this only happens if the binary is very close enough. A similar phenomena can be seen, and that's called dynamical scalarization, where let's imagine that you have two neutron stars equal mass with very small amount of scalar charge. Then you evolve this binary system. This plot shows the amount of scalar charge as a function of separation of this binary system. At first, you have wide separation and you don't have large amount of scalar charge, but as the binary evolves, separation becomes smaller and smaller, then it hits some critical separation or critical compactness of the system. Now you have all of a sudden enhanced growth, nonlinear growth again of the scalar charge. So this is very similar to the spontaneous scalarization, but this has things to do with what's happening inside a binary system and not isolated neutron star. So there's a difference between the two. This right plot shows or compares the gravitation wave spectrum for GR in black, which is a bit hard to see, and also the red one is in scalar tensor series. And the point of this plot is that there is a chance that maybe you can start to see deviation from the GR prediction already at frequency of somewhere around 500 Hz. Let me emphasize that this effect is something that binary pulsars cannot probe, and we do need gravitational wave observations to probe this kind of effect. Again, because this effect turns on when the separation is small enough. And in fact, I think using GW7817, we should be able to place some bounds on this dynamical scalarization, but as far as I know, nobody has done that yet. Okay, let me quickly move on to this last part, which is universal relations. As Jocelyn was explaining this morning, LIGO-Virgo correlation has managed to measure the tidal deformability, and this information can, in principle, be used to probe gravity as well. Let me give you one example, computed by Emanuele and Paolo, where they again looked at scalar tensor theories, and they looked at the relation between tidal deformability as a function of mass of a neutron star for different values of beta and also different equation of state. They picked three equation of state, blue, black, and red, and for each equation of state, they picked three different values of beta. The solid one corresponds to beta being zero, which reduces to GR, while you can pick beta to be like minus 4.5 or minus 6, and as you decrease beta, you enhance the amount of spontaneous scalarization being activated, and you see the relation to be hugely different from the GR prediction. So if you can measure these two quantities independently, and if you know which equation of state is correct a priori, then you can use such observations to probe this kind of modified theories of gravity. But again, the problem is, of course, we don't know for sure which equation of state is correct, so there's always degeneracy between uncertainties in equation of state and uncertainties in gravitational physics. So that's why universal relations that Phil was explaining this morning comes into play. These universal relations, like ILAQ relations as an example, projects out uncertainties in nuclear physics. But these relations are obtained assuming GR is correct, and once you move out of GR, then you typically find deviation away from GR prediction. So by using these relations, you can concentrate on testing GR without being affected by uncertainties in nuclear physics. And so let's take this ILAV relation predicted by GR as an example. Let's imagine that in future, by using double pulsar binary observations, you can measure moment of inertia to 10% accuracy, and you can measure gravitational wave observations to 40% accuracy. Then you can draw this hypothetical measurement error box in this plane. Let's see, if you go away from GR, then you get some different behavior. This is an example, imparity violating gravity. This theory has one coupling constant, which controls the amount of parity violation. And I picked a coupling constant such that it is marginally allowed from this future measurement. And that coupling constant value is actually a million times smaller than the upper bound that has been placed by solar system experiments obtained by Yassine. Which means that once these observations are realized, then we can place orders of magnitude stronger bounds in this kind of theory due to the strong field probe of neutron stars. Okay, I'm running out of time, so let me conclude. First, I explained that by using the current event, many people have already done tests of GR, including probing scalar dipole radiation, or probing non-GR polarization, or probing the number of space-time dimensions away from 4. In future, we should be able to place very stringent bounds on scalar tensor theories by using third-generation detectors or space-based detectors, and universal relations will help in breaking degeneracies between uncertainties in nuclear physics and gravitational physics. That's all. Thank you.
So for the spontaneous scalarization plots you showed us, and you showed us one for an isolated object and one for binary objects. In both of them, they both had this feature that there was a sort of rapid increase in the scalar charge, but then it also leveled off. So why does it come back down again?
I think that's because we have this Noether theorem, and we know that if you go to black hole limit, then scalar charge will be zero. So as you increase compactness, then at some point it approaches to the black hole value, which is scalar charge being zero.
And that's also true for the dynamical case? Or the
I see. I'm not sure that's a good point. And I don't know. I haven't seen any plot that actually shows the decrease in the scalar charge as you increase compactness of binary system. So that part I'm not sure.
Thanks.
Might be a related question. You had a plot of the tidal deformability.
Yes.
With the different values of beta, I think.
Yes.
Yes. So I can see that as beta becomes more and more negative, you deviate from the GR prediction before. But then you meet with the GR line again at
the end. That's right. Yeah, so yeah, this is exactly the same as what's happening for the isolated spontaneous scalarization case, where as you increase compactness, then at some point, scalar charge starts to decrease.
So many of the results you presented, I think, assume that the mass of the scalar field is zero. So if you wanted to have a massive scalar field, how do some of these constraints change?
So one interesting thing is that the parameter space that binary pulsar observations and gravitational waves can probe can be different. And the reason is if the, frequency of the system is smaller compared to the mass, meaning that if the mass of the scalar field is too large, then scalar dipole radiation gets suppressed. And since the frequency of separation of the binary pulsar system and also gravitational resources are totally different, you can try to constrain different parameter space. And typically what people have done is to look at massive branch decay theory, where there's only alpha parameter and also mass, and then you can place different constraints.
Okay, more questions? No? Yes?
For the I love Q relations, are those satisfied even if you go through a phase transition?
Those ones, even if you include phase transitions, they still lie on top of each other. So the universality still holds within 1% for I love Q, but not for binary love, the one that Phil was mentioning. Yeah.
So if there are no further questions, let's thank Kent again.
Thank you.